Good evening. I'm very excited to be able to kick off this whole year program about learning about Kashrut. It's a topic that is very near and dear to my heart. I'm really quite passionate about it, so I'm excited to have a chance to talk about it. And tonight what we're talking about to launch it is the spiritual aspect of Kashrut, rather than a nuts and bolts about the halachas of Kashrut, the details of which are many, and ask your local Orthodox rabbi about any of your questions that you have, because there's really a lot to understand and a lot to know. So what I'd like to do is just to set the table, literally, to get us started for the conversation. I don't think there is any generation that is like this one, that has the awareness of, the interest in, the commitment to, the concern about food than this generation. And I have to say it's really probably amongst the Western countries that are at a certain level of education and things like that. The Jewish community for sure is in that category. But I think there's just an explosion of information and knowledge that people have about the impact that food has on our bodies. Whether it is about the processing that happens to food, when the nutrients are removed, the white rice versus brown rice, whether it is about the gluten sensitivities, whether it's about lactose intolerance, whether it's about the nuts, or whether it is about hormones and antibiotics that are in our food, or whether it's what are the foods that the animals themselves are eating before they are slaughtered and given to us. There is so much knowledge and concern and understanding and appreciation about the fact that just at the physical level, that which goes into our food makes a huge difference. What maybe has escaped a lot of people's attention, is not on the radar screen, is the fact that our food also makes a tremendous difference to us spiritually and has a tremendous impact on our souls and the way we can live in this world and fulfill our purpose. So the question has to be, first of all, is what is it about food? So we know that Jewish people like to eat, we like food, even on Yom Kippur when we're not eating, we had the meal before, and then we're thinking about breaking the fast afterwards, so there's really not a time when there's not food, and we even have food outside, so if you've got to get something later. No offense to the cookies that are processed, and we know what processed food does to you, but there's also grapes out there, but they might have pesticides on them, which you can't see, but what are you gonna do? You can only be so careful. However, the laws of Kashrut really address the issue of food. But first, to kind of set the stage, we have to understand why food is so significant spiritually. That really requires us to understand and realize that we are primarily souls living in this world, that we are souls living in a body. And the fact that a body and soul can stay together at all is a great mystery and a great wonder. We even have the phrase that a person has to eat enough food to keep body and soul together. And that's not just like you have to eat enough to keep the mechanics going, the physiology going. There's also the idea that food itself keeps the neshama, keeps the soul in the body and keeps it together and keeps the flow of divine energy that God is trying to give us throughout every day, all the time, through our food. God is trying to give us that connection, and that what allows that to happen is the food that we eat. We are what we eat. And other than, there's probably no other thing that we do that has as big of an impact, bless you, than the food that we put into our bodies. Because just at a biological level, every amount of food that goes into us is absorbed, digested, absorbed, and becomes the very stuff of which we are made. It has a tremendous impact. Food itself is not limited to its nutrition and all of its different biological components. Every type of food also has a spiritual component. It's what allows it to keep the body and the soul together. The fact that the food has a spiritual component and a physical component is what allows it to act as a bonding agent between the body and the soul and keep it together. So it occurs to me, just as an aside, I don't know really anything about this part specifically, is that it's interesting that sometimes before somebody passes away, they lose their appetite and they stop eating. And we don't necessarily, the person doesn't necessarily pass away because they have starved to death, God forbid, but it may be that the loss of the appetite is a signaling also that the soul is about to disengage from the body and food is no longer necessary to keep those two beings together, that spiritual and physical connection. Is through the power of food. So So we look at food as having the ability to keep that together. Our body and soul, it becomes very important what that food is. So we could also take another step back and look at just the idea of the spiritual impact of eating alone, of how eating can be a spiritual activity. So we know that kashrut, the laws of kashrut, require us to be very attentive to details. You're standing in the store, you're checking the hechshers, you're looking at everything, where did it come from, who made it, calling up Rabbi Heisler, do you know this heksher? It looks like a good heksher, it says kosher on it, you know, there's a nice big K on it, so it must be good and kosher. So we are always looking at all these details, very mindful. So seriously, if we wanted to have a religion that was mindful about eating, there could have just been a commandment that says, be mindful when you eat. And that could have been expressed in a lot of different ways. It could have been, don't talk while you're eating, enjoy the experience, take it in, be aware of God, feel your soul, get energized. It could have expressed itself in that way. The attention to the idea that we are supposed to be mindful happens through kashrut, but it's also a byproduct. However, it also trains us, because somebody who is attentive to kashrut and attentive to those details has an opportunity to be spiritually trained to be attentive to other kinds of details. So if somebody has an attentive eye, and you're looking at something, I'll just give you an example. It's hard not to look once you're looking. So one of the ideas of kashrut is inspecting produce for insects. So now in Israel, they have produce that is grown in a special way that does not have to be inspected. However, I'm so used to inspecting that I just automatically, you know, pick up the lettuce leaf and I'm holding it up to the light to check and see if there are any bugs in it. And my son says, you don't have to check this lettuce here. It's okay. And I'm like, I just automatically do that because if you're used to looking, you're used to looking, you're used to searching for something that might be a problem. So looking is part of being attentive spiritually, and it's what we do, and it's one of the byproducts, literally, of the laws of kashrut. So food is important because it helps our bodies and souls stay together. And therefore, the food that we eat has to be special food. We know that different species require different foods. We even know that amongst human beings, that if people, for example, are training for a marathon, they will eat certain kinds of foods to give them more energy. They'll bulk up on carbohydrates or whatever it is they do. And there's lots of articles before Yom Kippur, what to eat so that you can make it through the fast, and every hour drink something, and then have a carbohydrate, and then have a protein, and then do this. And you spend your whole era of Yom Kippur getting yourself ready for Yom Kippur. And it's a whole big process because you want to do something to be able to go through that experience. So we know that different people, different species, different situations require a different food. So the Jewish people have been given a lofty task of being a goy kadosh, a holy nation. And a holy nation requires holy food. And the holy food is the food that we learn about in the laws of keeping kosher. When we look at those laws, and we're going to look in the Chumash a little bit, first of all, the laws all occur in the Parsha of Shmini. And the Parsha of Shmini has the laws also about the Kohanim, about, it's in the book of Vayikra, in the book of Leviticus, and it has to do with the holiness code. One of the ideas that people always raise is they think the kashrut is about health, physical health, and they think it's about cleanliness, and for some reason they think it's about trichinosis. And I'm not sure how trichinosis got elevated above all other medical ills to be like, well, God didn't want us to get trichinosis, so he said no pigs. I'm like, well, what about botulism? What about salmonella? There's a lot of other things I would have put on my list ahead of trichinosis. So, not to downplay trichinosis. I don't know anybody who's ever had it, but hopefully they don't get it. So, it's not about health. It's not about health. It's not about physical health. It's about spiritual health. It's about mental health. It's about our health of our character. It's about the health of our intellect. So it's interesting, while some people may not like the idea, or they may kind of be dismissive of, I don't need to be so spiritual, I'm just fine the way I am. If we were told that there was something that we were eating that was making us stupid, that we would be concerned about. Like, oh, no, I'm trying to conserve all my brain cells. I'm playing Sudoku at every spare moment to try to keep all my brain cells, keep my mind as clear and as, you know, fast working as possible. But the idea that food could do something to make us limited in our intellect, or could make us dull-witted, or could make us cruel, or could make us insensitive, that might be more of interest to us. And that, in fact, is what we're told about the laws of kashrut, is the food that is not kosher has that kind of an impact. So we're going to talk about that when we look at the list. So first of all, let's just talk about all of the different things that kashrut covers. I have to say myself that if I was going to create a religion, and I was going to make up some sort of an eating concept? Because eating, a lot of different religions, civilizations, cultures have like some sort of eating thing. Bless you. I would never in a million years come up with the laws of Kashrut. Seriously, a whole list of, you know, if you don't want to kill animals so you become a strict vegetarian, just say no animals. If you're disgusted by bugs and insects, so say no insects. You would say no insects except for the ones that hop and fly like grasshoppers or certain kinds of locusts. Those you can eat, and the Yemenites do. So yeah, those you can have. So who would come up with that? Choose its cud, split hoof, fins and scales, no milk and meat together. All of these things, you wouldn't come up with it. It doesn't bring a lot of adherence. People adhering to it. It doesn't bring a lot of members to that kind of religion. In fact, we know Christianity did away with this. Like, this isn't working for our recruitment efforts here, because people are not interested in that. But who would come up with this? And we're going to look and see that only the creator of the universe seriously could or would have come up with the list of things we're supposed to eat and not eat. And it covers the birds in the sky, the mammals, little creepy crawly things, things in the water, miniature insects. Every single thing has a category. And all of it is covered in Parsha Shmini that tells us exactly about how we can elevate ourselves. Going back to the idea that this is in Parsha Shmini, Shmini literally means the eighth, and it has to do with the eighth day that had to do with the Kohanim and them being inaugurated into their service. But the whole Parsha of Shmini is not just about the elevation of the Kohanim or the priests, but also about the Jewish people being elevated to a level of Kedusha, a level of holiness. And that idea is conveyed in the number eight, because the number eight itself is associated with transcendence. When we talk about the realm of eight, we're always talking about a transcendent, above nature, outside of the physical realm. So we have Brit Milah is on the eighth day, we have the eighth night of Hanukkah, the whole number eight we just finished with Shmini Atzeret, the eighth day where we have our celebration after the 7 days of Sukkot. The number eight is about transcendence, it's above nature. The laws of Kashrut appear in that parsha that is about the number eight. Then I was just playing around because I'm a big fan of gematria, which is numerical equivalent of letters. And so I'm like, I wonder what the gematria is of Kashrut. So, I was so happy to have a board here. So I'll just share this. So Kashrut is spelled Chaf, Shin, Resh, Vav, Tav. Okay, so gematria, the numerical equivalent of the Chaf is 20. Shin, does anybody know? 300. Resh is 200. Vav is 6. And Tav is 400. So if you add that all together, what do you get? You get 926. So in the state of gematria, there's called what's called the mispar katan, which means the small number, that you add the digits together until you get a single number. So if you add 9 plus 2 plus 6, what do you get? 17. And then you add those two together, and you get 8. So the word kashrut itself has, I was so excited, I didn't read that anywhere. I'm going to, I guess you can't like copyright a gematria, but I'm going to copyright that gematria. That the word itself of kashrut, digit sum of that is the number 8, and it's about the ability to transcend. That's what we're looking to do. The Jewish people are designed with a sensitivity of soul, and we can't really get into discussion about are Jewish souls different, or is it because our mission is different requires a different sensitivity. So everybody writes, you know, we're in the process of signing up women for a trip to Israel, and one of the questions we want to ask them is, do they have any food allergies? And it's like, do we really want to ask that? Everyone lists like 900 things. I have a sensitivity to this, I have a sensitivity to that. It says, anybody who's Jewish, their sensitivity, what they should really put on there at the top of the heap, I'm sensitive to non-kosher food. But that's the sensitivity that we all share. The Jewish neshama, the Jewish soul, is sensitive to non-kosher food and is sensitive and very responsive to kosher food. So what does kosher food allow us to do? Kosher food allows the soul-body connection to operate at its optimal peak efficiency. It does not make you into a good person. Because everyone will say, I know so-and-so, and they are strictly kosher, and they're a jerk. Okay. It's like the same thing. That somebody being intelligent doesn't make them a good person either. They could be a mastermind criminal. So there's lots of things. It just means that we're operating at our full potential, that we have all our wits about us. We have maximum power. In fact, if anything, I don't know, maybe if you don't consider yourself too good of a person, you don't want to keep kosher because not keeping kosher keeps you kind of dulled and a little bit depressed. So it might be better if somebody's not, that they don't have kosher food, because kosher food is going to make you, give you the most potential possible. It is, gives you access to all of your strength, all of your spiritual strength, all of your intellectual strength, and all of your character development strength. And that, of course, is what we're hoping to have, because we're required to have it in order to fulfill our purpose of showing and making God's presence in this world manifest. So let's take a look at some of the different examples here. And so in your Chumash, what I want to look at is where it tells us on page 605. Page 605 in Parshat Shmini, toward the very end of it. Oh, sorry. Yeah, just so you can share, we're not going to look at it so much there. We're going to look at the verses here. We're going to look at verse 43. So verse 43 on page 605. Who would like to just read that in the English? Jennifer, would you like 643? Verse 43.
Do not make your souls abominable by means of any teeming thing. Do not contaminate yourselves through them, lest you become contaminated through them.
Okay. So this is the prohibition against eating creeping creatures, which we're forbidden from eating. A lot of people say, I wasn't going to eat any creeping creatures anyway, so then you get the merit for not eating it, which is a really great thing. What's interesting is that the word that is used for becoming contaminated comes from the word tuma. To be tame means to be spiritually or ritually impure. To be impure means to be somehow blocked or cut off. What's interesting is if you go to the Hebrew, so you can only see this in the Hebrew, on the bottom line of the text, the second word from the left there is venit metem. Venit metem, which is translated lest you become contaminated, bam, through them. That word, nit metem, to be contaminated, is actually spelled incorrectly. Okay, the word tame that means to be impure, the root of that is, let me just erase our elevated kashrut word here. The root of that is tet mem aleph. Okay, tet mem aleph. You can see it by the word, if you go four words from the left, it says, the fifth word, I'm sorry, velo titam'u. Velo titam'u means you shall not, do not contaminate yourselves, by means of any, do not contaminate yourselves, velo titam'u, and you'll see the root there of tet mem aleph. That's how it should occur in all references to the idea of being impure. However, we see the neat Metam, that second word, has no aleph. So everybody, page 605, verse 43. So in that place there, venit metem bam, that you become contaminated, it says, don't read it as that word, to be contaminated. Read it venitam tem. Nitam tem, has anyone ever been called a mitum temet or mitum tam? That's good. You have to be. Sorry to hear that. What does it mean?
It's derogatory.
It's quite derogatory. If you look it up in the dictionary, I'm sure no one actually ever called you that. But
Only my mom.
And she meant it with full love, and she just meant it to kind of get your attention, I'm sure. It means stupid, fool, dull. You're in a stupor. That's what it means. So when it says here, it says, everybody, Rashi, who says that, from the Rambam Maimonides, who is our rationalist, to Moshe Chaim Lozato, who is a Kabbalist, every single person says, this means that this is saying, do not contaminate yourself with these things, lest you become stupid through them. This is going to dull you, it's going to cut off your spiritual connection, and it's going to diminish your capacity. It takes away your seichel, your intellect. And the problem with being dim and dulled is that it's not like pain. If someone's in pain, They know they're in pain because you're in pain. You feel it. If someone has dulled senses, what's the biggest problem with that?
You don't know it.
Okay? If you have dulled senses, you don't know you have dulled senses because you have dulled senses. So it is the challenge of that. Someone says, it's not having any impact on me. It's like, aha, the first symptom. You don't even know that you have the symptom. So this can happen with physical insensitivities also. If somebody doesn't have a power of touch, they can't feel things for whatever nerve reason. Remember, even when I was very pregnant, you know, skin stretched and all that, kind of less feeling on the tummy there. And I was cooking with a wok. We used to have a stove that was very low. And I'm sitting there cooking, not even realizing, because I couldn't feel it, that my shirt was practically on fire because I couldn't feel the heat. I could not feel it. So if you can't feel something, you can't do anything about it. So this is what makes it so dangerous. So the idea is we don't want to have anything dulled in us. We want to have full access. And it's the same thing as somebody has a blockage in their heart. You could say, I went along. You hear about people who had angioplasty or they had something, and they see that they had also, I was 90% blocked. It's like, how are you even walking around? It's like, people adapt. You adapt to your lessened, diminished capacity, and you function, but not at your ultimate level. So this is the idea of the neat metam, is don't become dulled through this. And that is the warning that is given to us. And the reverse also being true is by staying with kosher food, that then we stay completely, literally in the divine flow, and that our neshama has full access. The note is also made that the letter that is missing in that word, venit metam, is the letter Aleph, which symbolizes Aleph as in one, meaning one is Hashem, one is Hashem, one is Hashem, on heaven and earth. So this idea is that God's presence is somehow diminished in your life, and you don't have access to your full soul capacity. And that is something that we would, of course, want to avoid at all possible costs. The idea that all of these foods, that in and of itself is, I think, very compelling. Say, give me some kosher food. I don't want to have anything that is going to interfere with my ability to function in this world. Then we have specifics that in addition to being dulled, that there's certain things, unkosher food, that if we eat it has other kinds of disastrous consequences. So one is eating, which most of us aren't going to be likely to do anyway, is eating birds of prey. It says eating birds of prey, which are not kosher, none of them are kosher, that birds of prey, it says we always eat the prey, not the predators. Okay, so we eat prey, not predators. That birds of prey, it says that eating those can make you into a cruel person. Mixing milk and meat can make you into a cruel person. You think of, like, if we really cared about the cow and anything else, so we wouldn't kill it at all ever. So we wouldn't eat the cow and we wouldn't eat the milk. So that's what we would do. But that's not our concern. We have a way to eat meat and we have a way to eat milk. We just can't have them together. But the idea of that is it's a cruelty to even think of putting and having milk together with meat. In fact, so much so that we can't even benefit. You can't even feed your dog milk and meat together. You cannot benefit in any way, shape, or form. You cannot feed your non-Jewish employees milk and meat together. They can have treif, but they can't have milk and meat together. You cannot benefit from them having milk and meat together. It is so stay away, stay away, stay away from that. So that's in the area of cruelty. It says that insects, and some people are dismissive of insects because they are. Why do people think that eating insects is not such a big deal? Why?
Because they think they're gross.
Well, okay, so we don't usually eat insects, but as far as like checking lettuce, why do some people think like that shouldn't be necessary?
Can't taste them,
right? You can't taste them, you can hardly see them, and after all, they are so small, right? They're small. We're not talking about like big wasps or something. You can't eat the wasps either, but if you open up your lettuce and there's a dead wasp in it, so clearly you're not eating that either. But inspecting lettuce to see what it has, if it has insects on it. But I ask you, if anybody's a gardener, if you had a gardener who said, oh, you know, there's aphids all over your rose bushes, but, you know, they're so tiny, I would just ignore those. Or you have mites all over you, whatever, but, you know, they're so tiny, I would just ignore those. Like, what could they do? It says, the smaller it is, the more damage it can do, because it gets into us in a deeper way, and it's more likely that someone would eat a whole insect than they would eat a whole pig. or a whole anything else. So eating an entire creature is considered worse. If I told you that I made you a salad and there's just some itsy-bitsy little pigs in it, you would say, I'm not going to eat that. But if I said, oh, I didn't wash or check my lettuce, you'd say, no problem, no problem. I'm sure it's good, sure it's good. So it's not good. The insect page, the insect section of the laws of Kashrut are in the same section with the forbidden animals, the forbidden birds, the forbidden fish, the forbidden creepy crawly things. All of it is together. So some people say, well, I never, you know, my mother never checked. My grandmother, who was such a tzaddikus, she never checked. Said, you can thank DDT for that. There probably weren't so many insects. And I don't know about you, but I didn't even grow up with romaine lettuce. We had iceberg lettuce, okay? And in Eastern Europe, that's how we got horseradish as our marwar, because in the Talmud it says, what are you really supposed to use for your marwar? Romaine lettuce. But in Eastern Europe, Russia, Poland, they didn't know romaine lettuce. So, like, well, how about horseradish? Okay, so that's on the list too. So people weren't even eating these things. So it may have been that the idea of checking it and looking for it gets lost along the way. But it's in the same section of the Torah are those little things. There was a, this is a very sexist but interesting comment that was made. I couldn't find the source. Maybe someone knows. It says a man should be very careful, sexist, that he marries a wife, a woman who is God-fearing and intelligent, to make sure that things are checked for insects. Because it's the hardest law of kashrut, in my opinion, to keep. When I go to King Soopers, I'm not tempted by the... Of course, Steve does all the shopping, so I'm not tempted anyway. So, does the shopping. But I'm not tempted. I'm not buying lobster tails. I'm not buying anything. They could be selling, you know, a non-kosher brisket for 10 cents a pound, and I'm not like, oh, if only I didn't keep kosher, I would get this. So, I'm not tempted by that. But to bring produce into your home, and then in the privacy of your home, to say, I'm in charge of, I'm the mashkiach here, or the mashkicha, I am the supervisor of this, and I'm the only one who will know, me and God, whether this passes muster or not. So if you go to King Soopers, you might be a little embarrassed, especially if you're Jewish, the Jewish King Soopers, and you have your card. Everyone looks in your card anyway to see what you're buying. And if you have something on the couch, you're like, oh, I saw Eleanor, I can't believe she bought that. But if they see me throw their lettuce, nobody's going to say anything. That's on me, that's on my head, and that's my kashrut supervision in my home. And it's those little tiny insects. It takes more time to do that than it takes to make a brisket, than it takes to make a turkey, than it takes to take the fanciest dessert, is standing there for an hour checking lettuce. And especially if you don't even find any bugs after all that. So I'm always happy when I find them, because it's like, yes, I found them. So these little creatures here are part of the kashrut as well. And they can come in, and ingesting an entire creature is part of what can have a profound impact on our soul connection. It's interesting, I talked about kashrut in a class of people who are completely unaffiliated, and after that, this one woman, she eats treif, whatever, but she's like, I am checking my lettuce from now on, I'm not eating any insects. So this idea of what the non-kosher food can do to us is sometimes misunderstood and underappreciated and undervalued. These ideas about keeping our soul connection clear is what the laws of kashrut are all about. It's to help us reach our best potential, to help us reach our highest potential to fulfill our purpose in this world. And it says, sacred people need sacred food. All averas, anything that we do wrong, impacts our soul connection. All of anything. But eating, especially, because it's brought into us and absorbed and becomes part of us, and we do it multiple times a day, even if you are a axe murderer, you're probably not going out three times a day, 365 days a year, and committing that offense. So here we have an opportunity to do an act of sanctification and elevation and holiness three times a day, or if you're like me, five times a day, if not more, to say, to be very careful about the food that comes in to make sure that my soul connection is clear. The idea of this elevation is also referenced on the next page, on page 607. In some very interesting language, in verses 44 and 45, which lays to rest any idea that the laws of kashrut are about health. It says exactly here. Ariella, would you like to read those for us?
Well, I am Hashem, your God. You shall sanctify yourselves, and you will be holy, for I am holy. And you shall not contaminate your soul through any teeming thing that creeps on the earth. And the next one?
Please.
For I am Hashem, who elevates you from the land of Egypt to be a God unto you. You shall be holy, for I am holy.
So what are the, this is a summary statement about all the laws of Kashrut. The purpose is for the sake of holiness. But the language that's used, it's very interesting. It says in verse 45, for I am Hashem who elevates you. Hama'aleh etchem. I elevated you out of Egypt. That's not the word we usually hear. We usually hear who brought you out of the land of Egypt. We don't call the Pesach when we make Kiddush, we don't say the time of our elevation. We call it Zman Chayrutenu, the time of our freedom, Yitziat Mitzrayim, the exodus from Egypt. This is talking about an elevation, and I believe this is the only time where it's referenced like this. So there's a midrash that says on this, with putting words into God's mouth, saying, if for only the fact that you would not eat the prohibited foods that I have prohibited to you, it's worth it to me to have taken you out of Egypt. For that one mitzvah alone. And that elevation that can be achieved through adhering to the laws of Kashrut, so that is what makes it possible for us to achieve everything else. So this idea that God took us out of Egypt and that we have the ability to be elevated, that God elevated us through the laws of Kashrut, is part of the spiritual underpinnings of why we keep kosher. There's another aspect that, to me, inspires confidence that these are of divine origin and that no person came up with these. Again, who would come up with this kind of a system? Someone did say to me, I think it's because the rabbis all had Asperger's. Seriously, somebody said this, and that they were so, that they came up with those ideas. I'm like, that's an interesting idea. There might be people who do have Asperger's. I don't know. But I can't really say that could be a judgment on the entire Jewish people. You could say that too. They said Asperger's. I'm just saying what they said. Okay. Asperger's, obsessive compulsive. You name the problem. They're attributing it to some sort of psychological problem. The idea of what is described in here could only have come really from the creator of the universe. So let's take a look at where we can see this. So first of all, why don't we go to page 597. Truly, the laws of Kashrut are not normal. They don't describe any normal kind of a religious system. They just don't. What can I say? They just don't. Okay, the laws of Kashrut, I'm sorry, it begins there, the laws of Kashrut, and we're going to look at the animals. We're going to talk about mammals, four-legged mammals. What is the criteria for eating mammals? What do they have to have? Split hoof, a completely split hoof, and they have to chew their cud. Okay, so there it says that very clearly, verse 3, page 597, chapter 11, verse 3. Everything among the animals that has a split hoof, which is completely separated into double hoofs, and that brings up its cud, that one you may eat. And then it says, but this is what you shall not eat from among those that bring up their cud or that have split hooves. Now, in order to set the criteria for kashrut, split hooves and chew its cud, that's all you really need to say. The Torah could have ended right there. But it goes on to make statements that it doesn't have to make, and it makes statements that tells us that there's more knowledge and more wisdom behind this than we could possibly imagine. We see that there are going to be animals that have one or the other of the symbols of Kashrut, but not both. And they're listed for us. It says, and now, Jewish people, children of Israel, I'm going to tell you the ones that are going to have one symbol, but not both, and so therefore you can't have it. Again, it doesn't have to say any of this, because once you have your criteria, split hooves, chew's cud, we're done. But then it goes on to say that the camel brings up its cud, but the hoof is not split. And the same thing for the hyrax, which I went on to Google. Google is great. I thought, what does a hyrax look like anyway? So it's a little like badgery looking thing with, I don't know, I can't really describe it. It's a little creature. It's sometimes understood as to be a coney. It's sometimes how it's translated. And the hare, both, all of them bring up its cud, but the hoof is not split. And the pig, which is what we consider the ultimate treif thing, is its hoof is split, its external sign is there, but it does not chew its cud, the internal sign is not there. These are the only four animals, the only four species that are in this category. There are 5,000 species of mammals in the world that have been discovered so far. Never has there been any mammal that was discovered that was different than what is described here in the Torah. How did Moshe Rabbeinu get that information? He wasn't a zoologist. He may have been raised in the palace of Pharaoh, but he didn't have that kind of background. He didn't even have access to Google to say, can you give me a list of all the animals that have this but not that? He didn't have access to that. So that information can only come from the one who created all the animals and would know what was out there. And again, that the Torah does not have to tell us that at all, because it could have stopped at the split hooves and chewing its cud. If we take a look at the other descriptions of everything, let's just go through and see the categories. So we have land animals, which always reminds me of land shark, but land animals. Then we have permissible and forbidden fish. And then it continues on with the forbidden birds and forbidden and permissible insects. And each of these has a different criteria. So there's not even a consistent theme throughout everything. One is based on physical qualities. The forbidden fish has physical qualities. The forbidden birds are only a list of the names. It's not a list of the qualities, except that we can deduce from it that they are birds of prey, all except for three of them. And then we have forbidden and permissible insects. And again, is Moshe Rabbeinu, was anybody that he was associated with, a marine biologist? Were they whatever a person is who's an expert on insects? You think anybody sat there and said, well, let's look at this insect. Should we eat this one? No life. Let's not eat this one. Let's eat just only the ones that have hopping legs. That committee meeting doesn't even make any sense. So what would be behind that? The forbidden and permissible insects, the small creeping things, etc., etc. And it goes on and on. So those are the descriptions of the things that we can't eat, and that they could really only have been possibly come to us from the Creator, who tells us, this is the food, my Jewish people, my dear sweet people. You are supposed to be people of compassion. You're supposed to be people who have a discerning eye. You're supposed to be people who have the flow of divine energy just flowing through your souls and your bodies so that you can achieve your purpose. This is who you are. You are a Goy Kadosh. You are a holy nation. To be a holy nation requires holy food. The most spiritual, elevated concept of all is what we bring into ourselves and truly assimilate into us. We are what we eat, and we aren't what we don't eat. And the laws of kashrut help us appreciate that. So I'd like to open up to questions that are not halakha questions about specific, but if there are questions about the spiritual aspects or things about general ideas, happy to answer, respond to any of those, please.
So when you're genetically modified organisms and they're putting frog genes in tomatoes or pig genes in cucumbers, why is that kosher?
I don't know the answer to all of that. I know that it's being studied. There are people, halakhic, who are studying all that, because we have a big problem when you have genetic material that's being put into something else. It has to do with whether it makes a significant difference in its taste and in different properties, but I don't know the particulars of that. But because I don't know, it doesn't mean it's not known. So it is known.
I know this is personal, but hypothetically speaking, if you are ever feeling at that moment of weakness when you're feeling like challenged about, should I really check this or can't I really eat that or do I have to prepare it this way, you have like some tools that you can use to
grab onto that?
Yeah.
I have to tell you that for me, I think now is when I'm doing the mitzvah. Now is when I'm doing the mitzvah, because my other habits of kashrut right now are basically habit. We have our list of the products that we buy. Our meat is kosher. Our products have this whatever hechshers. It's a habit. I wouldn't really consider it. It's kind of really, there's what's called our bechira point, our place of free will. There's anything that is an accomplishment that you already have behind you, it's not your line of scrimmage. And anything that's too above you, that's too beyond you, is also not at your line of scrimmage. Just like in a game, not that I know really anything about it, but the yards that are way advanced, it's like the only place that counts is the line of scrimmage. And the only place that counts is your Bechira point for that situation. So it's like, aha, I'm at my Bechira point. And how do I know I'm at my Bechira point? When the thought comes through my mind of, am I like crazy or what? Or seriously, I only have 15 minutes until candle lighting, and I have 3 heads of romaine lettuce, and can I really get that done? Or will I say, I'll stop, and I won't use any lettuce that I haven't checked? And again, I'm in the privacy of my home. No one's seeing my grocery cart. It's between me and Hashem. I'm like, aha, this is the mitzvah moment. So in a way, it's the time I have an opportunity to really keep kosher, because the other things have really now been packaged. Now, it wasn't always that way. I mean, I remember when I stopped having prime rib, going out to eat prime rib and a baked potato with sour cream and butter, which makes my mouth water just saying it. Delicious. It's delicious. And we're actually not supposed to say, oh, I don't want it. We're supposed to say, oh, I would like it, but God has prohibited me from having it. But letting go of that, letting go of French fries at McDonald's, oh my gosh, well, I used to make my kids and I make them pay me a French fry tax. They had to give me 2 out of each thing. I'm taking that. Oh, I'm such a nice mother. So there was a while we're driving down Leedsdale past McDonald's. That was my Bechira point. And so the Bechira point changes along the way. So that just tells you where your Bechira point really is. And that's a good one to be at. Karen.
Just thinking now, almost any food that is not kosher, we could get now in some
kosher form.
Mm-hmm. So just thinking, not eating a cheeseburger, but we can. If it's a vegetarian hamburger and cheese, or it's a Fleischer hamburger and soy cheese.
That's right.
So when we think about these things, you know, they make kosher, sausage, they make in any shape or form, whether it's vegetarian or Fleischer. Right. So how do you, when we're thinking about these things, and I gave this up.
And those things are fine. In fact, we're told that Hashem has given us a kosher version of everything that is not permitted to us. There's even some sort of a fish that is supposed to taste like, I don't know what, something really good. I forgot what it was. Some fish is supposed to taste like something really amazing. So we have to understand, where does this all come from, our desire for food and the forbidden foods? It says it goes back to the very, very, very first beginning of creation. It says the very first mitzvah that was given to human beings was a kashrut. It was, don't eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And what did we do? We ate. It says, and ever since that time, we have had a taiva, we have had a yearning, a lust for that which is not permitted. And that, in fact, that has gone into all of our food, and that the laws of kashrut help us return to a pre-Garden of Eden, pre-eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil state, where we have full access to our spiritual potential, because we know that after the sin of eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, it says that Adam and Chava, that their capacities diminished in every way. They became physically smaller, they became not as great, that everything diminished as a result of that. The laws of kashrut and adhering to them help us regain part of what we lost in the Garden of Eden. Even the non-Jewish nations, the laws of the name Noah, the laws of the descendants of Noah, also have a law of kashrut. They're not allowed to eat a limb, pull a limb from a living animal. That's their law of kashrut, because it would also cause them to become even more cruel, possibly, and that's their level of sensitivity, and that they're supposed to adhere to that. So food has been in the picture, and eating has been an issue. Someone says, I have food issues. It's like, we've had food issues since we were created. It's because that is the nexus point. That's how we most bring in and interact with creation, is through food. Patty, and then
Tanya. I'm struggling with how to articulate the question.
Okay.
Back with this contamination or the dullness. I want to understand about the other nations. I mean, we know lots of very bright people who don't keep these laws, and lots of spiritual people who don't keep these laws.
Right.
So help me with the argument for that.
Okay. So I'm not really equipped to address it really completely, but a short answer is, okay, which is what I kind of said at the beginning, either it's a Jewish neshama is different and has a sensitivity to these things, and a non-Jewish soul does not have that sensitivity, or our mission as Jewish people requires a heightened sensitivity that is above and beyond what other people require. Because non-kosher food does nothing to non-Jewish people. We see people are plenty healthy, they're smart, they're whatever, but they cannot access Torah. They do not have that same connection. And you can be spiritual in a general kind of way, but this is talking about an intellectual spirituality where someone has access to chachma, to a wisdom, a spiritual wisdom, and a connection to God that is different. All I can say is it's different, just like you can have one animal and another animal. This dogs can't eat chocolate because they'll get sick. They're not supposed to really eat colic, except everybody does get their dogs colic, from what I understand. But, you know, all of these things is that it has an impact. It has an impact. But on non-Jews, it has no impact, because the Torah would not allow us to cause harm to other human beings either. So we can't say, yeah, you eat it. So we wouldn't do that. So that's all I can really say. I'm sure it's a much bigger...
Can I just do a caveat follow-up? I don't know that Pope Francis has his lettuce checked. So I'm guessing...
He should.
So my point is that he might be consuming little animals, or the Dalai Lama, or whatever.
For sure.
Do you think that... Are you making the argument that their connection with God is not a
connection? I would say it's different. It's different than a Jewish connection. I'm not going to make a qualitative evaluation of them as people, but I'd say if they were, I don't know, a Jewish person eats kosher food, a non-Jewish person is not obligated to eat kosher food.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, a quick question. So, over the last, like, 5-6 years, where we started bringing our food to family events, we bring our own food, you know, keep it separate. So, of course, like, they dig in and, like, now, look at your, like, it just, I don't know enough about it. How do you defend or argue, well, look at your meat. Look at, and they're comparing their antibiotic-free, healthy, organic, free-range, whole foods meat.
Yes.
Like, how could you say that your meat is better for your kids than what we're giving our kids?
Because
there's no argument.
I'm like,
well,
hold on. Okay, so two answers to that. One is that there is kosher meat that is available, you pay for it, that has meets those criteria. You pay for it. And you have to get it shipped in, so it's not like available at your local
and work
place.
At your house. Yeah.
And work at your house, and not eat very, and as somebody would say, so don't eat meat so often. Who said you had to have meat? You know, it's Shabbos and Yentif really should be enough. And who says the portions we have, to tell you, in our dishwasher at our house, we can only load, it happens to be there, we can only load 4 plates in it. 4 dinner plates. And I'm like, what kind of dishwasher is this? So we had to get it fixed for some other reason, and I said to the guy who came out to repair it, I said, I just want to ask you an unrelated question. Why does this dishwasher only hold 4 dinner plates? Do you realize? I said, it's only the two of us, but still, that's like 2 meals. So he said, oh, he said, that's because it's a model, it says plates have gotten bigger. Plates didn't used to be so big. And when plates were smaller, when people ate less and wanted smaller plates, they all fit. And so they don't fit yet. So now the newer models are bigger. Actually, they says they have less powerful motors because they had to give up the space for the motors in order to have a bigger area for the plates. Same thing, my great-grandmother's dishes for Pesach, the dinner plates are the size of our salad plates. So who says we have to be eating so much? So that's one answer. So it's like, if somebody really wants that kind of food. The other is it true? It would be ideal to have both, but we have a priority. My priority is that my soul and my body are healthy, healthfully connected. Because if that's not happening, then the incidental, quite frankly, the incidental, just my physical health, is of secondary value. First things first, it's a life choice. I need to be alive and have my soul fully available to me. So that, I don't know, if somebody doesn't believe in the soul, that argument is not going to help them. It's a hard question to answer. We can talk about that further. But yeah, Nina.
So that was part of one of my questions I have too. I mean, are we supposed to believe that it's more the discipline that God wants than what we're actually consuming as being healthy?
I mean, spiritually healthy, just, mean? Are you talking spiritually healthy? Kosher food?
I'm checking. Okay, so does he want us to be spiritually healthy or physically healthy with our kosher? Because it's not just meat. Like there's so much processed food,
kosher,
and it's so hard to believe that's what he would want us to be consuming.
God never commanded us to eat processed food.
Right.
That's our choice.
But there's healthy stuff that could be kosher, but it's not heksher, so that leads me to my second question.
Like what kind of, do you have an example?
And I know because grapes are just so spirit, you know. It's
grapes? Kind of, did you
yes. Have? So like for balsamic vinegar, really high in balsamic and yet you cannot find a heksher good balsamic vinegar. So that's one of it. The second part of my question is, how do you address that some families will accept some heksher and some families don't? So are you lifted or are you not lifted? Are you lifted that your spirit is not as high?
Rob Cook, the first chief rabbi of Israel, his idea and goal was to have one heksher. The Rabbanut heksher was supposed to be it for everybody. Anyone who goes to Israel today knows that that is not the case. It's like more flavors of heksher. Like you go to an ice cream thing, instead of 31 flavors, it's like, oh, what heksher do you want? Do you want batat? Do you want this? Do you want this? It's like it's a million out there. That's a different kind of an issue. That's another issue. Nobody says there has to be so many. When it talks about the different hekshers, there are differences in them. And sometimes they, oh, it's just all political. There are differences in the hekshers. There are some things where the, just as there are differences in everything, if you go to a doctor, just because a doctor has MD after their name doesn't necessarily mean that you want to go to him. If he got his degree in a mail order catalog.
But isn't it saying you're challenging one rabbi over another?
Well, sometimes it's not just the rabbi. It may be the rabbi. Is it a rabbi who is on the premises all the time or who can come and go, or just calls in and says, so what'd you bring into the plant today? There are differences in what people are doing, and we are making differentiations between them because it depends, not as a person, it was just saying that some people have higher standards than others, and everybody has to choose where they are. Ask your local Orthodox rabbi, is we're elevated to the extent that we are elevated. It's like you get out of it exactly what you put into it. If you want to go with something that's kind of a questionable thing, so then you may have a kind of half here, half there, I don't know, elevation from it. Some of it may be political, but sometimes you can find out exactly what the issue is. Somebody I called to find out from Rabbi Heisler, Bavad, about one heksher, and he is very discreet. He said, I can't recommend that. He didn't say, oh, those people are like, you know, whatever. He didn't say anything. He said, I can't recommend that. I said, can I just ask why? He said, well, the company that produces the food decided that they would be their own supervising agency. I'm like, hey. That's like saying, I say me, myself, and I, but I did a good job. It's like, that's not what Hashgacha is all about. So they have a big fancy heksher on their stuff, but there's nothing behind it. And that all he would say, unless I pressed, was like, I can't recommend it. So that we have to know. So that's the issue. When it comes to like the balsamic vinegar and like the high quality things, so this is for all of us here, is sometimes our relationship with food is over the top. We have access to so much. It's like, we are supposed to eat in order to keep body and soul together. We have so many luxuries. I never grew up with mango in my, mango, avocados, fruit around the year, like all these things. We have access to so much, and whenever we have access to a lot, we have a desire for that which is the best and the finest. And I'm not saying I'm an exception, because I make my husband get the most expensive kosher balsamic vinegar, as a matter of fact. It's like, he said, what about this other one? I'm like, whatever. I'm like, oh, it's, watered down. Now, I haven't had the really, really, really good, but there's something about having an approach to food in general, that while we have good food and nice food, that getting to a place where we have to have the very, very best is not necessarily what we're looking to do. Even though it's really hard when you see it, I go into Whole Foods and it's like, I didn't even know I wanted these things. It's like, it's beautiful, it smells good, it's gorgeous, it's inviting, it's delicious looking. How do I not get that stuff? It's like, don't have to have everything. There's something about having, being like, it's like, put it down a little bit. Maybe in the future there'll be somebody who does make it really good. When I'm in Israel, I can look and see if there's an Israeli balsamic vinegar that's really good.
I mean, I just look at it on the healthy side of it, of what's in some of our foods versus not.
Right. In some sense, like, one doesn't have to have balsamic vinegar. There's lots of things that we take on as, I need this. And I say I need it too. Like, and I just made a chicken recipe that called for a cup and a half of balsamic vinegar. I'm like, oh my gosh, he just bought it last week and now it's like this much less. Oh, I hope you like that chicken dish that doesn't have a half of balsamic vinegar. It's expensive. So, what can I say? It's hard. Our relationship with food is, we have to be careful with it in general. It says a tzaddik eats to his soul's contentment, for his soul. It says, enough to have the body and soul be together, and extra on Shabbos, but otherwise kind of modest, very modest. When you talk about from a health concern, that's a different issue about that, but then if we can't have a healthy version of it, it may be that it's something that we just say no to it. it could be possible that if I can't find a good place, that I just say no to it. Other questions at all?
So one last thing, I mean, apart from the healthy body, healthy soul concept, one of the intended, unintended realities of eating kosher is it creates differences between you and other people. For example, the Jewish people, it creates a barrier between Jewish people and other nations.
Right.
Nothing is as obvious and visible as eating differently. Whether it be in the workplace, where whatever it is, it does create a barrier and it creates a difference. I think it may be a positive thing, but whatever it is, it does create an obvious difference.
Correct, and it's supposed to. We are supposed to be a separate people. A goy kadosh, the word kadosh means separate. So the part of the difference, the definition of holiness is separation, which is also goes against our grain because we like to be with everybody. But we are supposed to stay separate from the other nations. When we eat other people's food and eat with people in a complete way, it says, when you eat other people's food, you eat their ideas. So it's like, that's why people have business lunches. It's like, why do you think they're taking you to lunch? Because they want to, while you eat your food, they want to talk to you about their idea, and the idea goes in with the food. So having a separation between food and saying, I'm not really having my meal with you because I'm having this different food, is exactly what it's supposed to be. And it does make a difference. You know, we were at a conference and they brought us kosher food all like wrapped up, and somebody at the table says, well, the least they could have done for you is to put it on a plate instead of leaving it with all that stuff. And I'm like, well, actually, that was the main idea, was like to have it, you know, with all the foil, and figure if Senator Joe Lieberman could do it, we could do it. But yes, it does create a difference. And sometimes it's a great discussion point, a point of conversation. People ask about it. They ask about the laws of kashrut. They ask about being Jewish. So we are supposed to be separate. People think Jews like to be separate. The truth is we don't like to be separate. We like to be with everyone. And the laws of kashrut do have that impact on making us separate. And it is also a discipline. So when that was raised too about the idea of a discipline, there's something to be said about being disciplined in anything in one's life, because all achievements require discipline. In whatever field of study, academics, our business, our creativity, all things require being able to get a handle on our basic animal instincts. And food is the most powerful thing that we can have.
Just as a follow-up, I'm sure at this conference when you were asked about, you know, kashrut, you didn't say, well, actually, you know, the Jewish people are a holy nation, so we need to eat holy food. I mean, so how do you
answer that? And say, well, we're Jewish, and we follow the Jewish dietary laws.
That's it, huh?
And then sometimes people will say, well, what are those? I mean, remember as a kid growing up in Littleton, where people, you know, there were no Jews, and someone invited me over for lunch and said, we have kosher pickles. And I was like, great. So, you know, that people are actually usually fairly interested in it, and they can appreciate it. Jewish people usually feel upset about putting themselves in a, I'm different than you. Other people actually tend to think it's really interesting. And they're like, oh, well, that's interesting. And sometimes your food is better than theirs. Like, we went to one conference, and they brought a dessert. First of all, they gave us enough food that was like for Yuntif. And we went to this restaurant where everything was like very nouveau cuisine, and it was like one piece of whatever it was, like tilted on a tomato. It was like this big. And they bring us like brisket in these big foil pans and all this stuff. And they're looking at us just how did you get that food? It's usually the question I get is, how did you get that food? And then they brought a dessert that was like a tiered thing. And I mean, you know, I get hungry when someone else is making the food. And the woman sitting next to me goes, you're not going to eat that whole thing yourself, are you? I wouldn't say what I was planning to. I said, oh, no, not at all. Did you want to have some with me? I'd be happy to share it with you. But yes, I was going to eat the whole thing. So usually what we get is it, what radiates is our attitude toward it. Where it's the most difficult, honestly, is with other Jewish people. Rather than with non-Jews. Because other Jewish people feel judged by what we're doing, and so when there's those differences, that makes it more challenging. And then, you know, there's only so much you can do to be open, accepting, but graceful and firm about what you're doing, and hope for the best. That's all we can do. We are, you know, we live in exile. This is part of the exile situation, and not all the Jewish people are on the same page, and it makes for some sticky situations, which is definitely true. But it's, you know, when people say, well, I have a kosher home, the most important home to have kosher is this home of our soul, which is our body. We are the walking home of the Shekhinah, of the divine presence in ourselves. And that's my first priority. Everything else really needs to be secondary. So a person doesn't need to be mean about it. They don't need to be, you know, whatever, too snobby to other people. And it needs to be handled with discretion. But the idea is to be able to stand one's ground. We learned, just to conclude, that Daniel, do you know the story of Daniel in the lion's den? So unbeknownst to me, so you know what happened with Daniel in the lion's den? What didn't happen to him?
He didn't get eaten
by the lions, right? Even though he got fed to the lions, the lions didn't touch him. Said, why did they touch him? Says that there was so much kedusha, so much holiness radiating from him. And what was the source of that kedusha? Is that he only ate kosher food. Even when he and three others who had been drafted to be in the service of the king to work in the palace were told that they would be given like the royal banquet food, and they're like, ixnay on that. We'll have vegetables that are checkable vegetables and water. And the person who was over them, their supervisor, said, you can't eat that because you're going to become diminished and you're going to waste away, and then the king's going to be mad at me because you're risking my life. They said, okay, let us try it for 10 days and you'll see there won't be a problem. For 10 days, I had this strict diet, and they saw that what happened is that actually they became healthier and more vibrant and stronger and whatever, and so then they were left alone from that time forward. So that Daniel specifically, that his strength came from having the kedusha, having that holiness radiate through him from his care and being so specific about keeping kosher. So if a person can withstand the orders of the king, we might be able to deal with our family and friends and say, you know what? I love you. I'm happy to be with you. And let's see how we can make this work. So God willing, we can keep in mind, my first priority is to keep my body and soul together. After that, I'll worry about everything else. Obviously, we're supposed to take care of ourselves. That's a mitzvah of the Torah also. We are supposed to be healthy, but not just for health's sake, but because our body is the house, the dwelling place of our soul, and it needs to be in a good place to live. So God willing, our understanding and appreciation of kashrut will help us get more and more clarity and more understanding so that we can be as bright, as intelligent, as wise, as spiritually connected as possible so that we can fulfill every potential that we have inside of us. Thank you very much.